From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, President Obama's former EPA chief is back home in Boston, speaking out against the Trump administration's effort to roll back her former boss's Clean Power program.
We did not have a war on coal. EPA's job is to protect public health, and that's what we did here.
Also today, our Common Health segment explores new research that suggests if you really want to know how someone is feeling, close your eyes and use your ears.
What we're finding here is the same grade school message. Listen well.
Plus, the Red Sox made it interesting, but fall short again in the postseason. And a new black national anthem. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
And the home of the brave.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. And let's begin today with the Trump administration's intention to roll back one of former President Barack Obama's main initiatives to curb greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. In a moment, we'll hear from Obama's former EPA chief, Gina McCarthy, who's back home in Boston. But first, Scott Pruitt, the current head of the EPA, says he will end Obama's Clean Power Plan, which is trying to encourage states to move away from coal toward cleaner sources of power. Here's Pruitt speaking yesterday in Kentucky.
The past administration was unapologetic. They were using every bit of power to use the EPA to pick winners and losers in how we generate electricity in this country.
Joining us now is Gina McCarthy, former administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency under President Obama. She's a native of Massachusetts and joins us from Jamaica Plain. Thanks for being with us today.
It's great to be here, Anthony. Thanks for inviting me.
Sure. So Scott Pruitt declared that the war against coal is over, and he argues that the Obama administration overstepped its legal authority with the Clean Power Plan. What's your view of the effect that this will have going forward, the Trump administration's action?
Well, first of all, Anthony, let me say that we did not have a war on coal. EPA's job is to protect public health and the natural resources that we need to survive and to thrive. And that's what we did here. We actually were addressing a significant and, if you will, existential challenge of climate change. But what we were specifically doing was reducing carbon pollution in a sector, the power sector, that was generating a lot.
And can you remind us what the Obama Clean Power Plan would have done specifically?
Yeah, well, it already did, Anthony, so it's not gone yet. It actually set limits in the power sector for coal and natural gas facilities that would require reductions in those facilities on a state-by-state basis. So it basically was just setting limits on pollution the same way we set limits on other pollution, like those that are cause ozone and toxic substances that are emitted.
Right.
So it was, that's what it is. And it really wasn't done to pick winners and losers. And in fact, it actually doesn't, the law doesn't give us the authority to do that. And we certainly didn't. We left tremendous flexibility up to states on how to meet these state standards.
Right. Now, and yet, as you know, some 28 states challenged the regulation. Before he replaced you, Scott Pruitt sided with industry officials who said that it went too far. And last year, the Supreme Court blocked implementation of the regulation. So respond to the Trump administration's case that the Clean Power Plan exceeded the administration's authority.
Well, I think, as you will see from a lot of the litigation that's happened so far, is that it's not unusual in a case of this significance to have a number of litigants challenging a rule. We're used to that. But what we did in order to protect ourselves was to make sure that we were actually following science, doing what the law says. We took an approach that was specifically sensitive to the need to make sure that we didn't impact the reliability and affordability of the energy system. And we took what really would be considered, I think, by all standards, the most cooperative federalism approach that the agency could take, which was actually to set a standard and allow states and show them that there were numerous options for meeting these standards. So any accusation that we didn't do the outreach we were supposed to do or provide ultimate flexibility is simply not founded in the law and not founded in the court documents that are available to everybody in the rule itself.
Yeah.
So I think we did our homework on this one, Anthony. We got 4.3 million comments, not because we didn't seek them, but because we did. We wanted to understand what the choices were and how we get this done in a way that is directly based on law and science.
Right. Now, environmental groups and several states plan to challenge the repeal proposal in federal courts, and they're going to argue that against Mr. Pruitt's move on both scientific and economic grounds. Look, I have two questions here, and I'm going to ask this one first. If the mm-hmm. Trump administration prevails, can you talk about the effect? What would concern you the most if the Trump administration were to prevail here?
Well, I mean, there's a little bit of a process here, Anthony. Let me make sure that people understand it. This is a proposed rule. It opens up for comment to everybody to ask whether or not it does only one thing. It repeals the Clean Power Plan. It doesn't replace it with anything, which is going to be, I think, a significantly difficult strategy for this administration to survive under court challenge. But having said that, what does it do? It, you know, like many of the announcements that the administration has made on environmental standards and regulations that we've relied on for a long time, it really creates a significant level of uncertainty. Now, I will begin by saying the clean energy train in this country has left the station. It is moving forward. We know that renewable energy and energy efficiency are the most inexpensive ways to deliver really good and solid and reliable electricity. They're being integrated all across the country, with individual states having requirements for it, never mind anything that the federal government might do or not do with the Clean Power Plan. So that is moving forward. But what it does do, and it does this in concert with this administration saying that they're pulling out of the Paris Agreement, is it just it sort of not only cedes to other countries the kind of innovation that we need moving forward in those economic opportunities and jobs that come with it, but it really puts us as an outlier in the discussion of how to work with the rest of the world to address what we know is a planetary issue.
Yeah, so let me ask you what you see sort of happening here in your own state of Massachusetts, indeed in states like California, New York, which are already moving ahead of the targets set by the Clean Power Plan. I mean, is that sort of where the action shifts, in your view, to the state level?
Absolutely. And you know, we saw it happen. In California, they reauthorized their cap and trade program, and they also expanded it to other sectors. So they are moving forward. In the Northeast and the Mid-Atlantic, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative states, which are both Republican and Democratic governors, they have agreed to tighten their cap, and they're looking at opportunities to do that moving forward and to potentially even incorporate some strategies for reducing greenhouse gases in the transportation sector. So there is a lot of activity. You have a number of cities in other states that are very active. And the one thing that I think gives me a tremendous amount of comfort is that there are so many states already which meet the targets identified in the Clean Power Plan, you know, that aren't even due until 2022, 2024. So we know that this is moving forward. It's just a very bad signal. And that bad signal could actually disadvantage this country in terms of maintaining our leadership, not just in environment, but in particular on innovative clean energy moving forward that would potentially give other countries a leg up on those jobs and those improvements and those technologies. I have no idea why we would want to do that.
Well, let me throw one more sort of pushback at you. And of course, you don't have to listen to the radio too closely to come across this concern or read it in the newspaper. I mean, Scott Pruitt was down in Kentucky yesterday to make this announcement. That's coal country. That's where you hear a lot of folks sort of saying, hey, the federal government was trying to pick winners and losers and essentially put us out of work.
Yeah. Well, I think that you just have to look at the facts, Anthony, and I say this with all sympathy for those areas, but the coal industry has been losing jobs since the 1980s. It is not a technology that is going to lead us into the future. And the damage of these kind of signals, frankly, this signal of repealing the Clean Power Plan is to me just a signal. I don't think it's going to survive in terms of court challenges because it doesn't follow the law. It doesn't do what legally the agency has been told it must do because of the climate science and the challenge of climate change. So I think what the biggest problem that I worry about is that when you have shifts in the economy like we're seeing, regardless of the Clean Power Plan, we're moving towards clean energy because we have to, and it is now more cost-effective and marketable than coal is in the energy sector. It is simply too expensive to run coal units. And the good news is that when you shift to cleaner energy, it's better for public health as well as climate change. But the challenge is that when you deny that, when you go into coal country and you give folks, you know, some sense that the world is going to reverse itself. You know, it just does. It's not based on the history of the coal sector, which I've said has been losing jobs for decades. And it isn't an opportunity to talk to them about what their future really is. How do we begin to reinvest in those communities? How do we put those people to work rather than make promises for a very few that is working not within the best interests of the many?
All right. Well, big challenge indeed out there. That's Gina McCarthy. She's the former administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency under President Barack Obama. She joined us from Jamaica Plain today in Boston. Gina McCarthy, many thanks.
Anthony, thank you.
If you want to know how someone is feeling, it might be best to close your eyes and just listen. That's the message from a Yale University study just out today. And here to tell us more is Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health. Hi, Carrie.
Hey, Anthony.
So I'm really interested in this, and I have to confess a bit of a bias here. I'm a radio person, and I believe in the power of sound, the importance of listening. So tell us what this study from the journal American Psychologist found.
Well, I have to confess, I've drunk that same Kool-Aid of the power
the
of audio.
Radio Kool-Aid.
Yes. And this study is actually a compilation of five experiments. And it looked at how accurately people could read how other people were feeling during an interaction, a sort of a teasing dialogue. And in some cases, you would just look at the people interacting. So you would have just visual as they talk with each other. In some cases, you could only listen to the interaction with no visual. And in some cases, you could both look and listen. And you'd try to assess, you know, what are they feeling? Are they feeling anger? Are they feeling happiness, shame, pride? What?
Yeah, and I guess most people would assume that both looking and listening would give you the best read on what that person is thinking, the emotions that are in play, because you could both see facial expressions, hear the tone of the voice.
Right. So that's what you would think. But here's the researcher, Michael Krauss. He's an assistant professor at Yale School of Management.
What we found across our studies is that the voice is best relative to having all channels of communication, relative to just looking at the face for perceiving emotions accurately in interactions.
And he says it wasn't a huge effect. It was small to medium. But even so, it was surprising that voice alone, so listening alone, could help you read how someone was feeling better than both looking at them and listening to them.
Really interesting. So what might explain this?
Right. What might explain this? And also for me, the burning question is, so does this mean like when you or I are having, shall we say, a difficult conversation with our respective spouses, does this mean that maybe we should close our eyes as we listen?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Or turn out the lights and talk in the dark, right? So Michael Krauss says, you know, you never want to take just one intriguing study or even five and try to run with them too far. And that's certainly true. This is all just food for thought. But he says there is a reason that, in fact, it might be a good idea to have tough conversations without visual contact.
That if you are trying to really read somebody and you are doing it by trying to listen to what they're saying, also trying to see their facial expressions and parse those nuances, that's a lot of work. And it might be easier, it might be more efficient, and it also conveys a lot of the rich emotion if you just really focus on the voice.
So just focus on the voice. And here's another reason why Krauss says that voice may be a more accurate way to read somebody's emotions. He says it's because we tend to be better at dissembling or concealing our emotions in our facial expressions and body language than in our voices.
You mean the ways we do that intentionally? I mean, we can plaster a smile on our face or sit up straight or stick out our chest or all those kinds of things that you're told to do as you head into a job interview.
Right, to create an impression. And there's a whole cottage industry of advice on how to put your best foot or your best face forward.
But right? Carrie, I mean, can't we dissemble with our voices too? I mean, I can sound tentative and I can sound authoritative whenever I want, right?
Well,
I,
yeah, but that's because you're a pro, Anthony, and you're probably, you know, especially good at having to sound calm and rational on the air, even on certain days when I happen to know that a few minutes earlier you may not have been feeling so calm and rational. But you know, there's some research about how we leak out into our voices, and in fact Krauss has another paper in press about how we can often tell an awful lot about somebody. So not a pro like you, but just an average person. We can tell their age, their ethnic group, even if we hear just seven words they say.
It's really interesting. And it seems to go against conventional wisdom that, face-to-face interaction is especially important, that it just adds value and bandwidth to communication. I mean, it goes without saying that's true in private life, but and also in the workplace. Right?
Very much so in the workplace. Yeah. And because Krauss is at the Yale School of Management, I asked him whether, like, wouldn't this study be hated by all the companies that provide video conferencing services? And that's big business, all the gurus who say you have to do face-to-face. And he says at his school, they do recommend face-to-face interaction. And also that there's an element of it that his study didn't look at.
Part of what's good about a video conference is that you can hold people more accountable to the interaction. If I'm on video, I'm less likely to be on my email. I'm less likely to be, I don't know, making my grocery list. And if you are taking away the video, you take away some of the accountability.
Now, Anthony, of course, some of us actually do our email and grocery lists even during in-person face-to-face meetings. But let's not talk about that.
No, let's not go there.
Okay.
Let's just say that it sounds like this study, the latest reminder of the importance of listening.
Absolutely.
Right?
And Michael Krauss says, you know, particularly in these times and in this culture we live in where we're constantly bombarded by information,
you may get distracted from time to time. And that's going to be a problem for reading emotions. And what we're finding here is how important it is to really stop and listen to what people are saying for, you know, accurately understanding their intentions. And that might be the biggest takeaway from this work is, you know, still the same grade school message, listen well.
So listen well. And, you know, I'm sorry to sound like our fall fundraiser, which is over. It's over. But maybe when you listen to the radio rather than watch TV, you might be getting an especially accurate sense of how people feel as they speak and maybe even of who they are in some way. Don't you think, Anthony?
I think that's absolutely true. But again, I've had this bias for the sound of people's voices for a long, long time. In any case, it's always a pleasure to listen to Carrie Goldberg. She's host of WBUR's Common Health, and you can find a link to her latest post on this study from Yale on listening versus looking to read emotions at our website, radioboston.org. Carrie, thank you.
You're welcome.
Stay with us. Coming up, the composer who created a black version of the national anthem. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and here's a version of the national anthem that many of you probably haven't heard.
Oh, say,
This is Isai Barnwell's version of the Star Spangled Banner. Barnwell is a former member of Sweet Honey and the Rock and is now a master teacher and choral clinician. After actor Harry Belafonte asked her to do a black version of the national anthem, she came up with this energetic interpretation, including this politically charged lyric. Land of the free and the home of the slave. And Isai Barnwell joins us now from NPR in Washington, D.C. And welcome to Radio Boston. Great to have you, Isai Barnwell. Great pleasure.
Thank you very much, Anthony.
Yes.
Good to be with you.
So tell us about this interpretation. Tell me the story about sort of how it began, where it came from.
Well, it did begin with Harry Belafonte asking me, I guess in January or February of 2016, if I thought I could do a black version of the Star Spangled Banner. And at that time, he was thinking about some kind of voter registration project that really might involve getting people to register to vote. And he said, you know, if you can do it, perhaps maybe we could get the Morehouse Glee Club to sing it. And so I thought about it, and that night I started laying down tracks, and the Morehouse Glee Club part was really, really beneficial for me because I have a low voice anyway, and so I didn't have to stretch for those notes that everybody stretches for.
It is a hard one to sing for a lot of people, isn't it?
It is. It can be very challenging.
Yeah.
But I got totally involved in it, and the elements for me that made it black had to do with the rhythm that was underneath it. If you just listen to it, it sounds almost like a marching rhythm. But if you listen closely, there's another kind of syncopation underneath it. And that rhythm actually comes out of Gullah culture in South Carolina. My father came from South Carolina. My mother came from Los Angeles. And so I sort
great.
Of have this in my blood. And this felt, you know, when I started working on it, it perfectly fit. And I just went with it.
Isai, let's just listen for
sure.
just for a few more seconds because
sure.
you've done such nice descriptions here. I just want to hear it. All right, we came right up on that line again, home of the brave and home of the slave. That was unintentional, but I did want to ask you about that. What's the significance of that line to you? Because that's got some political charge to it.
Yes, it does. It does. It really has to do with what was going on at the time that this was written. Mm. And the fact that we have, as African Americans, fought in every war that has taken place in this country. And that we were not acknowledged in this song, which became our national anthem. So my interest in adding the word slave, which I'm certainly happy that it rhymed,
right.
was to kind of not only take ownership because of the rhythm that I had laid underneath it, but to bring an awareness to the fact that as folk who were enslaved, we actually fought in all of the wars that have happened in this country.
Yeah. Now, Isai, I noticed, too, at the end, so the line reverts to home of the free and land of the brave, right?
Yes.
Do I have that right?
So, that is correct.
So there's, it almost suggests a kind of evolution, I guess, and an acknowledgement that, that we did move from slavery to freedom, but still, let's not forget that important history.
Yes, and there's another thought, and I really am still checking on this to find out when we use the term brave with reference to Native Americans, is that a derogatory term or is that an acceptable term? Because both definitions work for me in that place. And so we don't think of the brave as being here, when we were fighting that war, and the fact that they, too, are fighting in all of the wars that we have in this country and with other countries. But I wanted to acknowledge them, and leaving the word brave there gave me the territory to be able to use one or the other meaning.
And really interesting. There have been other alternative renditions of the Star Spangled Banner over the years. Whitney Houston did a version at the Super Bowl. There was a controversial version performed by Jose Feliciano at the 1968 World Series. And then, of course, there's this, great version by Jimi Hendrix at Woodstock. Let's just listen to this for a little bit. So, without dating myself too much, I remember when that came out, and it was hugely exciting for me as a kid to listen to that.
Yes.
What I didn't anticipate was the number of people that, you know, really reacted negatively to it, like he was really giving the finger to this country.
Yes. There is something about taking ownership.
Yeah.
And when you take ownership and you are not the majority, it feels strange.
Yeah.
And I think that that is what has happened in the case of Jose Feliciano. I remember an uproar around that, as well as around Jimi Hendrix. And there may be one around this version as well.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. Have you heard back from folks? Have people reached out to either compliment you or to take issue with some of the, as we mentioned, some of the political charge in your version?
So far, only the people who love it have written or called or spoken back. So I haven't gotten negative criticism from it. I anticipate that there are folk who would not feel that this was the anthem that they're familiar with.
Sure. Now, you mentioned, you made reference to this, in many ways, the national anthem, difficult song to sing in many ways. What was, you talked a little bit about sort of how you went about making it your own, but what was the biggest challenge with that? What was the difficult part of that?
Actually, there wasn't anything difficult about it. Once the rhythm came, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. I've sung all of the voices. It's all ad lib. I did one major take of the whole thing, and it all fell together. But of course, I have a background in singing that does that anyway. It's what the women of Sweet Honey in the Rock do. Mm. You know, when I joined the group, I had to sing things I'd never heard before. That happened the first time I sang with the group at Battery Park in New York, where thousands of people were there around No Nukes, etc. And so it's something that I really am challenged by and enjoy doing, which is creating all of the other lines that are possible. That's what composers do. That's what arrangers do.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm both. So it was the most exciting challenge that I'd had in a while, and I really was grateful for it.
Well, Isai Barnwell, you brought up Sweet Honey in the Rock, and I'm glad you did, because I wanted to ask you about your experience in that group. In fact, we've got something to play. This is Sweet Honey in the Rock's On Children from your 1988 album, Breathes, right? Here it is.
Breaths, yes.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Your children are not your children. They are the sons and the daughters of life's longing for itself. They come through you, but they are not from you. And though they are with you, they belong not to you.
Sweet Honey and the Rock there from the album On Children, from the song On Children from their album Breaths, and Isai Barnwell. That was such a great group. I was really happy to be reminded of them and to hear that sound. Can you tell me something about what it was like to perform together with them?
It was fabulous every time because things were not, you know, they were not in starch. They were really in fluid mode. And so we could improvise. We could add things that we hadn't added before, soften things that we hadn't before, create a new line that no one had heard. It was a joy because we were always creating. We were not just reciting something that we had previously learned and reinterpreting in that way. But we could sing, you know, a line totally differently. Hmm. And it was really the person who started the song who would set the tone of it, the pacing of it, the intention of it. And very often it was not what we might have expected, because that person was not the same person as the one who had sung it the last time. It was the same individual, but it was not the same person, because they were shaped by what was going on in the community that we were in or in the time that we were in. And so we were responsive, I think, on so many levels, not only to each other, but to the community, to the world, to what was going on in the news. And that made Sweet Honey, I think, a formidable group, because we weren't stuck in a particular groove.
Hmm.
We could change, we could move, we could reinterpret things musically, and because we could reinterpret them musically, we could also reinterpret them politically, emotionally, spiritually, in all different ways.
Wow, well, it was such a great group, and I'm really happy to hear you talk about it that way. I want to come back to this question about the national anthem and the reinterpretation of it. The national anthem, of course, it's been involved recently in controversy with NFL players kneeling or staying in the locker room during its playing at football games to protest systematic racism and police brutality. Some say bringing politics into NFL games is misplaced. How are you thinking about this whole controversy that's playing out across the country right now?
You know, I think we as individuals have a responsibility to take a stand wherever we are. And if and when we decide, now is the time to take a stand. And so I really applaud Mr. Kaepernick, because he has been doing that for a little over a year now and has begun to get his message out so that people understand what he is doing and why he is doing it. Now, the fact that he's misunderstood by some people is always a possibility. But I really respect him. I respect those players who are joining him. And even though I've never been to a ball game in my life, I really, really respect that where you are is where you have to take your stand. And so I feel like he has done that, and the players who are joining him now are doing the same thing.
Well, that's Esai Barnwell. She's a musician, master teacher, and choral clinician. She arranged the black version of the Star Spangled Banner. She's also a former member of Sweet Honey on the Rock, the great group that performed between 1979 and 2013. Esai Barnwell, what a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, and Sweet Honey is still out there.
Glad to hear that. All right, we're gonna go out this break with Esai's arrangement of the national anthem. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. We've been reminded a lot lately that Mother Nature is often a source of great beauty and great danger. That intersection is the focus of the latest story from our Kind World series. WBUR's Erica Lance has the story of how dozens of people who didn't even know each other came together for a dramatic rescue on a beach.
I like going to the beach. We can find sand dollars,
stingrays, jellyfish,
and seashells and crabs.
On a warm summer day, 11-year-old Noah and 8-year-old Stephen played in the water while their mom watched. It was just the sort of day Roberta Ursary dreamed of. A few months before, Roberta had been a correctional officer in Georgia, but they came here whenever they could, to the Florida sand and sun. When Roberta's dad died, she thought, why not live in the place you love? So she packed up her mom, her husband, her 2 girls and 2 boys, and they all moved to Panama City, Florida.
Our little piece of heaven down here.
One day in July, Roberta was scanning the horizon from her beach chair when she realized she couldn't see Stephen and Noah.
Where's the boys? So I went to looking up and down the beach, and I seen them in the water. All I heard was them screaming for help.
We was trying to ride the waves to get to shore, but the riptide kept on pulling our
us back. And it was strong.
Me and Noah was going to get drowned.
A woman was already with the boys, but when she and her wife tried to save them, she got stuck too. Roberta dropped her phone and ran into the water as some men on shore warned her it was too dangerous.
And I said, I don't care. I said, those are my kids. I'm going out there. And so I started swimming out. The boys were on their stomachs holding on to their boogie boards. They were just crying and begging me to get them out of there. And I told them, I said, I'm going to get you. I'm going to get you. Mommy's going to get you. And I could feel the suction up underneath. There was waves coming over on top of us, knocking me under.
She pulled, she pushed, she tried everything she could think of to get her sons out of the rip current that was dragging them out to sea.
And it was not working.
One by one, Roberta's other family members saw what was happening and rushed out to help.
Our uncle came in after Noah. Our granny swam over. Our dad swam over.
So he ends up stuck.
Now 10 people were caught in the water, including most of Roberta's family. All she could think was they were all about to die. Meanwhile, down the beach, Jessica Simmons and her husband Derek noticed the police lights.
People still standing on the beach are very unsure of what they want to do, just staring.
Then Derek thought of something he'd seen on TV, how ants link their bodies together into bridges so they can cross water.
So that's when my husband started yelling, grab arms, let's grab arms.
He and about 5 other people held hands and made a human chain.
These people just started following in. I mean, they just started running into the water, just linking together.
Derek's mom and nieces joined. Locals and tourists from all over the world jumped in. Some couldn't speak English, some couldn't swim, but the chain grew longer and longer.
Each person trusted each other to make sure they came out of that water alive.
We don't know how many joined, but Derek and Jessica think close to 70 people linked arms that day. Finally, they were just 15 feet from Roberta and her family.
The guy on the very end, he was screaming. He had his arm out as far as he could reach it, and he was like, grab my arm, grab my arm. And I could hear the father going, we can't reach you.
So Jessica took a chance. She swam out with her boogie board, past the chain, and all the way to the group that was stranded.
And that's when I realized how bad it was.
Roberta's 27-year-old nephew held on to his grandmother, who was having a heart attack in the water.
And he was drowning himself to keep her above. And she's like, just let me be, save yourself. And then she'd go underwater and he'd bring her back up. He's like, Grandma, Grandma, you gotta stay with me. You gotta keep talking to me.
Roberta was on her back, struggling to stay alive.
I was just so exhausted that I couldn't even keep my eyes open.
She said, yeah, just save my boys. Don't worry about me. It was haunting because I felt like she was going to just give up any minute. And she said, I can't do it anymore. Just let me go. And I looked at her with all seriousness, I guess because my adrenaline was rushed. And I said, no, hon, that's not going to happen today. So I gave her the boogie board.
Roberta and little Steven got on it.
And I said, I need you to kick as hard as you can. Kick, kick, kick. And so I grabbed the string on the boogie board and started pulling it towards the human chain as she was kicking.
Somehow she made it and handed off the rope.
The guy on the end starts yelling, pull. And then you could hear about 5 people down. Another guy says, pull.
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 It almost sounded like a choir.
Pull. Pull. Pull.
And you could hear it over that ocean.
Just echo back all the way to the beach.
All of them moved toward shore, pulling Roberta and her son to safety, then back for the next trip. Derek and Jessica swam back and forth, bringing people one by one to the human chain. Somehow, it was working.
I can remember having the grandmother in the water, and she was so out of it that she thought that I was the nephew. And I just looked at her like she was my grandmother. At that moment, I didn't feel like they were strangers anymore.
Derek thought they'd save maybe 2 people that day. But by the end, all 10 were safe on the sand. Even Roberta's mother made it, though she's still recovering from her heart attack. As everyone went their separate ways, Roberta met with Jessica, the woman who'd saved her sons.
And I just grabbed a hold of her and hugged her and told her, thank you.
Words couldn't say all that she was feeling, but with that hug, they became family. They still talk almost every day.
I told her she's kind of stuck with us.
The names of most of the people in that human chain are a mystery. But for Derek, those people are a hope for the future.
There's just a lot of hate in this world. And that day, for that hour, we were humans.
Humans who took a chance, held hands, and ventured together into the sea.
WBUR's Erica Lance with that story from our Kind World series. You can find more Kind World stories and share your own at wbur.org/kindworld. Okay, we can say this about yesterday. They made it interesting, but your 2017 Red Sox came up short, falling 5-4 to the Houston Astros in Game 4 of the ALDS at Fenway Park. Despite some heroics from pitcher Chris Sale, a big home run from Andrew Benintendi, and an inside-the-park homer from Rafael Devers in the bottom of the ninth, no less, despite all of that, in the end, the better team won, so the Houston Astros move on to play for the American League pennant. And the Red Sox and their fans, well, they'll have all winter to figure out what went wrong and how to make this team better. Joining us now to talk a little bit about that is WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer. Hey, Shira.
Hi, Anthony.
Good to see you in here. And also with us is Boston Herald sports columnist Steve Buckley. Steve, good to have you. Welcome back.
Good to be back, and good to see Shira swinging a pickaxe at Fenway yesterday like the old days.
Is that what that was? I was wondering why you left here with a pickaxe. Okay, so I don't know where to start here, but let's talk about the ninth inning. It felt like something big was going to happen, an inside-the-park home run by rookie Rafael Devers. Before we look forward, Shira, that must have been an exciting moment at Fenway Park.
Yeah, I mean, you get the crowd on its feet, and you think, this is it. I mean, it had that sort of karmic feel to it when you have an inside-the-park home run, a rarity in baseball, and you thought, all right, this is a special moment. Something special is going to happen here in the bottom of the ninth. And then Pedroia grounds out to end the game and the season.
And the season. So, Steve Buckley, this is the second straight year the Red Sox won the AL East Division and second straight year that they were eliminated in the first round of the playoffs. What's your sort of take on what happened to this team, or how do you sum them up?
Well, unfortunately, this is Boston. And
fortunately, depending on your point of view, but go ahead.
And a lot of times when a team wins a division title and goes out in the first round, it's still seen as a happy moment, a climb up. For instance, in Minneapolis, the Minnesota Twins were the wild card team this year. They were a horrible team last year, and they've got a Hall of Fame manager in Paul Molitor, and they ascended to the wild card perch. And I'm sure that if you wandered through the Twin Cities right now, people would be very happy with the season the Twins had. This is Boston. It's a high payroll. It's a team with annual expectations to go deep into the playoffs, if not win the World Series, coupled with the fact that all four teams have won titles in the 21st century, including five by the Patriots in the Super Bowl. So fighting a good fight, glass half filled, silver linings. None of that, unfortunately, applies to the Red Sox, which is why we're here right now, firing a manager and, you know, front page of the Herald today, my column and all that. I think it's kind of fun. It might not be fun for John Farrell right now, but I think at the end of the day, you want to play in a city where people are that passionate about baseball. So therefore, there are no silver linings, glasses half filled, and life lessons. It's all about they didn't go deeper than people wanted them to go. Therefore, there must be where we are right now.
So, Steve, I want to talk to you about your column today. But first, let's hear John Farrell in a post-game interview. He was asked if he believed he's the manager to take the Red Sox to the next level. In other words, is he going to be around next season? Should he be? Here's a little bit of what he said.
Personally, yes, I feel confident in that. I know that we've got an opportunity to assess where we are as a team. I can't begin to talk about what the offseason plans are and what the changes that may be realized. But still, there's a lot of good things that are going on here.
So, Steve, you wrote today that it's time to fire Farrell. Why?
There's two roads you can go down. One is strategy, the actual button-pushing X's and O's, and then there's the entire mood of the clubhouse. And they did win 93 games, and they won the AL East. But there was, I think, a disconnect with reality with this team this year. John Farrell, and I've beaten this to death, but after David Price had his first big blow-up with the media, Farrell's response to say was to say that accountability is a two-way street. And then that's a nice thing to say to defend his player, but I never felt there was any accountability by the Red Sox this season, right up until the very end when Pedroia finally said, hey, we weren't good enough. But you went from the David Ortiz clubhouse, which was loud and brash and exciting and running up and down the streets of Boston saying, hey, I'll come see us play, you know, symbolically. It turned into the David Price clubhouse, which was moody and defensive and insecure. And I think that manifested itself to the degree that in my travels throughout the city, and I hear it every day from people, I don't like this team. Well, they do like this team. They just don't like this edition of the Red Sox. And
that's right, they don't like it as much as they used to. Sure, what do you talk to Steve or tell me what you think about this idea that, I mean, because there's this sort of funny idea in baseball that when a team doesn't do everything it should or is expected to do, you can't fire the whole team, so you fire the manager.
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting. You know, after the game in the clubhouse last night, you saw John Farrell going around and talking and hugging some of the players and shaking hands. And I don't know if that was for sure. But it certainly looked like he had a decent relationship with most of the players on the team. And I'm always curious, and maybe, Steve, you can answer this, but one of the things that fascinates me about pro sports is there comes a time inevitably when a coach, a manager, loses the team. And I don't think it was just, you know, the way he handled the David Price incident, you know, in midsummer. I think there's more to it. Do you have any sense from having covered this team throughout the season when it was that Farrell, it seems, lost the team or lost control of the team?
Well, I'll answer that by saying something I say often. In sports media, it's not uncommon for a newspaper or TV station or radio station or whatever to front its person who covers the team as a quote-unquote insider. We all do it. The Globe has its insider. We have our insider at the Herald and all that. But nobody is truly an insider because we get such a small look at the team during those moments when they are made available to us. Behind closed doors, that's when you have to be an insider, and we are not inside. So exactly when it happened, the where you can make the little check mark in the timeline, I honestly don't know. I'd be guessing, but it was clear to me last year. He made some interesting, quotes, moves with lineup changes and pitching changes and so forth, and we saw that in this postseason where he started Devin Marrero, who I think he's evolved into a utility player, over Rafael Devers, who's an exciting young player who needs to be in there every day.
Man, I love watching him play. I just love watching him play.
And just to not answer your question, but to go back to something that you said at the beginning about Devers' inside the park home run and how much excitement there was in that, I still say one of the most exciting moments in my teenage years was going to a game at Fenway, and John Kennedy, who had just been acquired the day before in his first at bat at Fenway, hit an inside the park home run against the Cleveland Indians, and I was there, like, wow, inside the park home run. There's something when a guy hits a home run, we watch the flight of the ball into the stands, and we stand up and cheer. And from that point on, after the ball goes into the stands, it's all we all do it by muscle memory. We stand up and we cheer, and the guy rounds the bases and all that. But with an inside the park home run, there's such an air of anticipation because you see the ball carom go to the right, and your very first thought as a baseball fan is, oh, my God, this might be an inside the park home run. And you see it build and build and build. He rounds third, and he scores. And Scherer was absolutely correct. At that moment, they were back in this game. They're down by a run. They're going to win this game. They're going to win the World Series. And then it all comes
and all.
I like how you go from they're going to win this game to they're going to win the World Series. That's very Boston.
So we're down to we've got less than a minute to go, and I want to make sure I get this question to both of you. What happens? Is this team better next year? Steve, we have sort of about 20 seconds to answer that question. So give me your quick thought about that.
If they go out and get a bat, they have to build the offense. But I think the pitching staff in place, if David Price can give the Red Sox a full season next year, what we saw glimpses of this season, he becomes a dominant pitcher. Chris Sale. I think Rick Porcello could bounce back. Don't forget they have Stephen Wright, who missed most of the season. The building blocks are in place for a really good pitching staff, and pitching staffs win games.
All right. What do you think, Cher?
I'm going to agree with everything Buck said about the pitching staff, and then I'll just throw in the youth movement. You've got, as we've mentioned time and again, I don't think you'll be hearing this. You can't hear this name enough. Rafael Devers, 20-year-old, that baby-faced slugger, you know, with the inside the home run, other dramatic moments. You've got Andrew Benintendi. You've got Mookie Betts. I mean, you like the core and the youthfulness of this team going
forward.
All
right. Lots to build on. We've got to say it. Wait till next spring. Steve Buckley, Boston Herald sports columnist, and Shira Springer, WBR Sports and Society reporter. Thank you both for today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. What is it, 120 days till pitchers and catchers report? Something
like
that?
There we go. Right around the corner. That's it. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.